Okay, very excited to have Pinar Govench from Sour Studio with us for this podcast. So thank you so much for making the time for us this evening where we are now, but I think it's the afternoon where you are. Whereabouts are you?
I'm in New York City, and yeah, thank you for having me.
All good. So Sour Studio, we're talking a media company, but approaching kind of some really key issues at the minute. Is it cool to give us a quick overview of kind of what you do?
Yeah, so Sour is a hybrid design studio with the mission of addressing social and urban problems. We recognize that's a very big mission. Therefore, it's very natural for us to have ongoing research and a collaboration with many wonderfully diverse people with different lived and professional experiences. As a missionless studio, we find our work also being very diverse across different typologies, from architecture to service design to product design. And we also recognize, you know, at the core of these problems lie humans, right? Like, we are the cause, we're the cause and the affected party of and by these problems. So therefore, we have a very human-centered and community-led design approach, which we very much enjoy doing.
I mean, it sounds amazing. And the thing that struck me from looking through different aspects of your work is obviously that, you know, when you say kind of studio, we're talking, you know, multimedia, we're talking podcasts, we're talking, you know, leaflets and designs, websites and, you know, all other multimedia things as well. And I'm intrigued to, I don't know, I want to kind of dive in quite at the deep end, really. And I want to go, because a lot of your stuff is about challenging perception, challenging norms, challenging these habits that we've created, right? And I wanted to ask you, is there a defined point where you sort of went, yeah, we're doing this wrong? You know, there's a better way of doing all this stuff. Was there something that kind of triggered that? Or is it just a general thing? I don't know.
I feel like all of us probably since our like toddlerhood realized something like, do these make sense? Like, do these really should be this way? But I feel like when we first set up back in maybe like end of 2015, I think we like officially set up and then we really started working 2016. We were all from like diverse backgrounds and we just knew we wanted to do purposeful stuff. We had like no idea, no clear mission. We just want to work on meaningful things. And then I think in a few years, it was evident like, okay, like we want to be problem solvers and we recognize we can't solve all problems today. So around, I would say like 2017 or 2018, it became clear like, okay, we want to be problem solvers and we recognize we can't solve all problems today, but we kind of need to take a step, right? Like we have to understand one is greater than zero and we need to be doing something. So I think then like our passion really lied around, you know, social and urban issues. And obviously environment is a big part of both, right? So it's like embedded into it. So with that, I think we officially announced that as our mission. And then, we became Sour to both represent our mission and kind of our attitude. I mean, to your point exactly, like Sour is a play on the word social and urban, but we also felt like it represents the attitude in the sense that we embrace discomfort. We're okay with being in the gray and like discovering and challenging. And we said there is enough sugarcoating in the world, so it's time to get real and be sour. So I feel like it's definitely not the easy route because when we're like trying to challenge everything, but it makes the most sense for all of us and everyone on the team.
I think, you know, for me, from looking at the stuff that's been created so far in this journey for you, it's like you're doing it, you know, you're creating the frameworks, you're having the discussions that need to be had. And they're the things that people might talk about and go, oh, that's rubbish or that's wrong or that's, you know, not right. And there's got to be a better way of doing that. But you're actually creating the frameworks that, you know, if people, you know, have a good look at them and discover them, that there's a way of doing it. And the other thing is that it seems to be city led. And you know, there's always this idea. I mean, certainly where we are in the UK, this thing of sustainability is all about green fields and, you know, kind of like lots of nature and all that sort of stuff. And actually, you can do sustainability anywhere, you know. And you guys are developing, you know, these tools and these frameworks that allow for people to explore those things. And I think that's really cool.
Well, I'm so glad that that resonates. We identify ourselves as actionists, right? Like, we're not necessarily advocates. We don't take it to the street, you know, like we're not lobbying for things, but we want to really do something about the things we're passionate about. And that kind of also explains how we work. Like, yes, we're a design studio. We have project commissions, but we also function like an incubator. Sometimes like some project money gets funneled into our like incubation, right, to really continue on the research and launch things without relying or waiting on anyone. And exactly to your point, like really trying to understand what does sustainability mean to each and every one of us and how can we act on it? I think that's the biggest problem in many of these global issues where there are so many big terminologies, like paralyzing amount of information on systems where we feel like we're not in control of or can't do anything about. Whereas, again, like going back to one is greater than zero, there's always some individual steps we can all take. And how can we take them and not just like sit with our awareness? Because I feel like in many of our research, as we like also interview people, awareness serves until a certain point and then it starts turning into frustration when you can't act on it, right? Like we're just like all hyper aware and we can't do anything about it and we all have anxiety and mental health issues. That's not where we want to go to. So like really showing like, what can you do today? Like what is the small step you can do today and really ideate that both on, I guess, like general public, right? But also with corporations too, because I think the same frustration is experienced by members of companies as well.
Do you feel like we've hit the wall with where we could go with the current systems that exist? I'm just thinking about your what's wrong with capitalism kind of podcast. And I was going, you know, all of these titles, these podcasts, I'm going, you're right. Yeah. It's almost paralyzing, isn't it? Because you think, yeah, there's got to be a better way. And I'm sure it's not far away. And we've just got to, I mean, there was the line that I read in this book recently, I had an audio book and it said, we can change the world. All we've got to do is agree. You know?
Yeah.
And as soon as exactly. Everyone agrees, we can change the world, you know? Yeah. Dive in, mate, I'll hog it.
That's just the problem, isn't it? People agreeing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we're not, which is very ironic because we survived as a species because we have the skill set to like collaborate, and yet we're not really good at practicing that on a day to day. But I also think like it's not that anything was wrong, right? Like the problem is like really whatever is launched out into the world, either we get too attached to it, we're resistant to change, or we make it about politics or other things, right? Whereas like, no, like we do not know what the hell we're doing in this world. We're prototyping and we should iterate, right? Like if we have looked at it that way, obviously like, okay, capitalism had its own benefit for many reasons by also like giving some capability for people who did not come from, you know, heritage backgrounds to really grow their economic levels. Fine. But then like, can we also, you know, recognize its vices and iterate like what that might look like today? So I think really like nothing that we ever created on this planet should be taken as like golden standards and guidelines that we abide by, right? Like the only thing that does not change is change. And if we all just like get on board with that, I think we would be open to like iterate further and adapt based on like our daily day-to-day realities. Like if we are living with like climate change and talking about like depleting resources by 2050, I mean, I would just say it's like pure sense, like logical sense to like start changing things.
Yeah, I like that thought process. My favorite line from a film is from Dogma, the Kevin film, where he talks about, it's Chris Rock talking to one of the characters and they're talking about having an idea, and it's always better to have an idea and not a belief, because a belief becomes ingrained and becomes something you want to fight anybody who challenges it against.
Whether it's
malleable. You can iterate, you can ideate on all of that. You can change it.
Exactly.
An idea is something that can grow and can get bigger and separate and break things off. So that's why I've always liked that line.
Yeah, that's good.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing. Much better in the film.
I mean, we set up all the structures that lead to like the patterns and events of the world. Our mental models create that, right? And so much of that is just like ingrained with our beliefs, prejudices, biases, our own past experiences dictating the future, like planning, right? All of that. And if we just like had kind of what tech industry does at like a corporate level, like, oh, this is beta version. Let's see what the other one looks like. Oh, did it work? Let's get community feedback. Let's iterate. Like if it was the mindset around it, if it was flexible as such, I think we would have been in a much better place in 2022.
Do you feel like, because we're talking about one of the minefields that appears to exist, particularly with the proliferation of sort of online attitudes and, you know, the kind of the masks that we wear on online and the avatars that we can present ourselves online as, this kind of spectrum of perspective and this kind of ocean of opinion and all of those things, you know? And I think it relates to what you were just talking about with belief, but I'm going to get big questions. How do we overcome our own individual and collective sense of ego? Because that always appears to be a bit of a barrier to change and a barrier to embrace the new ideas.
That's such a good question. And we were doing a panel on what's wrong with architecture. And that was like the first idea we explored, like, what are we going to do with the egos of like the design world? And they're like, no, the egos are there. We just like need to create the practices. But I think it's also like we mention and practice and communicate and storytell a lot about co-design, right? And it, like, to us, it's just like, it's very naive to believe that we would solve world problems by our genius selves, right? Like, we do need to collaborate. We do need to co-create with people who are going to end up using things, right? So it's just like feels organic to us. Whereas when we talk about this in certain, even like design circles, there is like a reaction to the word co-design in the sense that it feels diminishing, I guess, right? Like they feel like, well, we're the experts, like we're the designers, they're not designing. And we're kind of like, well, you can't really design without the insights from them. And even if you do, maybe it's like uninformed, right? So we really need to your point, and unfortunately, this takes like catastrophes for people to realize some shit basically does not matter, right? Like, I mean, if the pandemic itself was not a case study enough that, you know, our built environment failed us, our systems fail us, our supply chains fail us, like, I don't know what is. And another problem on top of ego is that we have, like, I think as a survival mechanism, we just live on our short-term memory. Like, it's easy for us to forget all the trauma that we go through or put under the rug. So with that, I think, like, even, like, some of the realizations we had during the pandemic, I see that, like, kind of stripping away a little bit with more, like, economic and supply chain concerns. So you're kind of like, well, we're great at just creating cycles, aren't we? We're just like, do one thing, and then one chaos happens, we learn from it, we change things a little bit, and then we go back to like our common. But I think this is where, like, I guess, like, the awareness and discussion, and this is why we're really big on storytelling, is to continue to communicate and talk about co-design, normalize this as a practice, so that we all have egos, and I mean, they project in like different ways, but how we react to something that should be common practice could change. And we can be very egotistical about some other things, right? Yeah. So I think there's definitely, I mean, even compared to 2 years ago, I feel like there's larger conversation around inclusive design, co-creation, co-design. Is it common practice yet? No. But I guess, like, even the fact that it's more widely like talked about is exciting to see. And I feel like that like resistance to like change or like hiding behind our ego to go against these like processes that are necessary, like, and merely a survival mechanism at this point to address the problems in the world, I think they will slowly diminish. I'm hopeful.
Little and often, like, you know, gradual, yeah. You know, I want to sort of dive a bit deeper into the idea of co-design, because, you know, that challenges some of the very fabric of the institutions and structures that we create, because we like being told, and it's safe to have to not have the responsibility sometimes and to pass that off to somebody else. So to somebody who's firmly in a hierarchical model of existing, let's say in the workplace, how would you propose, you know, that they would embrace co-design. You know, what would be a way in which they could kind of, and you know, because it might just be a totally alien concept. I know we're talking about it, and we're all big in it with circularity in the way that we, you know, develop our stuff. But you know, to somebody who doesn't even has never heard that word before, you know, how would you kind of explain that to them?
I mean, to me, in the most basic terms, it's basically showing up at the table with your own skill sets to contribute to the design process, right? Like, when we put it this way, some reaction might be like, oh, but we do this already, but not really, because not all of these people are engaged in the process from commencement to end, right? Like in product design, the common practice today, users would be given like a very close to final prototype to give feedback on. From that like that point on, how much you can change in that prototype is questionable. So you may incorporate some of those comments, but that's it, and then you launch, right? What we say in co-design, no, we actually do research together, right? Like we would, for example, create what we call a co-creation panel of people, not like a big number, right? Maybe 5 to 6 people to really have like deep dive conversations together about things from the beginning. And these same people will continue throughout the process. We will go back to them for like synthesis, basically saying, these are the insights we generated. This is what we heard. Does this make sense? And co-ideating together. Like, I feel like when we say co-design, some people think like, oh, like we're all going to show up on Rhino software and model 3D model together. No, like you're basically part of the design process together. So everybody just needs to come with their own experience, right? Like, for example, we work often with people with disabilities. I cannot ever, I can try to empathize, but I can never understand 100% what their lived experience is. Their feedback and insights are crucial to create proper design frameworks and inclusive design outcomes, right? Other than that, like, I can't, like, what am I going to design on? My own assumptions, which is then going to turn something in, like, half informed, really. And this is like a great example, because I think, you know, this is probably why 90% of our surroundings are inaccessible, because people are not included in the process. So I think in that sense, really understanding and believing that lived experiences are equally as important as professional experiences, and people should be compensated properly as well. This is not like, you know, it's not a surprise that so many of the overlooked and underserved communities have distrust to institutions because they're asked a bunch of questions and not compensated and don't get outcomes. So really shifting that and creating proper partnership throughout a process and working together to realize outcomes. Not giving away your designer expert hat, really. So I think I would want to just like emphasize that for anybody who's like reacting to the word co-design.
See, when I hear those things, I'm a product manager. That's my day job. So that immediately sounds to me like software product management, which I do, which is the talking to users, making sure that you're understanding their user journey, how they want things to be versus how you can do them, working together to get that. No, I'm on camera, mate.
No, it's just with the mic.
Oh, with the mic, sorry. But that sort of approach of the user-centric development about bringing people into that process, because if we don't develop something that works for that person, then essentially we've built something that's useless. And our structures are kind of built on that. So if you look at a council or you look at a city-wide department that looks after the waste management and everything else, it's all built from that hierarchical past of landowners and serfs doing that. It just mirrors that setup. Somebody at the top has the power, it comes down. And that product thinking and co-design thinking is the bit that's flipping on its head, because product-led organisations like the one I work for is bottom up. So yes, there are some things that you need to do from a corporate structure, but it should all come from the people who are at the, for want of a better phrase, at the coal face, the people who are doing the do and have that experience. That co-design thing is essentially what we've done here. So we've got some volunteers who have disabilities, and one of the first things we did with them as they joined was go, how do we make this space? We can't change the space. The space is what it is, but how do we make this more accessible for you? How do we do something? So one of our volunteers has a sight impairment. So just put in, he can see colours. see bright colours. So we put some fluorescent tape on all the things that are corners and sharp, so that he can see that.
Exactly.
Even if it's that, it's that sort of thing, I think.
And it's a little thing, but it's what that does is that we're obviously talking about inclusion here, but it also creates belonging. And I think in that co-design process, belonging and feeling a part of something.
Ownership,
yeah,
exactly. And I think it is as simple as that, right? Because if we, this was common practice, and to ensure, like, asking the questions, who is not in the room right now, why they're not in the room, and then try to include them in the conversations, everything around us would have been more inclusive. And to highlight on that too, that's not the thing, because inclusive design is also not universal design, right? Like, we're not trying to solve everyone's problem at once. We're trying to be inclusive of the needs and wants of the audience that we're co-designing with. So the idea is that it will, as in being inclusive, it will serve a broader audience, which it is, right? And a lot of, like, accessibility measures also work for elders, also work for a pregnant woman, also could work for kids, right? So it does serve a broader audience. And again, if we go back and iterate, we can be more and more inclusive to then strive for being universal. So I think there's also a misconception and expectation, like, there needs to be, like, expectation management from companies too. Sometimes they just, like, see it as a one and done. Like, we're very inclusive and there you go. Like, no, like, representation is also not inclusion, right? Just because you hired one Black person doesn't mean you're an inclusive workplace. So I think we just need to, like, continue to work and, like, recognize that.
That's great. Now, we're talking a lot so far about ideas, and we're talking a lot about concepts. I'm really interested in hearing about what you know of people that have taken, you know, your frameworks and your ideas and similar, and actually created reality and changed reality for people. And are there kind of good examples of that you've experienced?
Yeah, of course, there are not many, but we've definitely started to see more and more implementation. I think, you know, because we're trying to, like, do, like, design innovation in very archaic infrastructure, some things that we do stay in concept, unfortunately. And unfortunately, I think sometimes we're also not discussing the real reasons of why we're not realizing some projects, right? Like, for example, we would have a design, we would prototype it, we would, like, put out all the ways that it can be realized. And then because of lack of, like, identifying capable vendors, the company might deem it unmanufacturable, and you're kind of like, but we produced it, you know? So it's kind of, so there's many, many layers to, like, get, I feel like that's, like, the unspoken project. Like, there's a project brief, and there's, like, the entire navigation of the system to make sure something gets realized, right? And that's, like, the unspoken project, and it's the harder project. But we had great examples. Like, one, for example, we recently worked with Department of Labor here in U.S., they basically told us we have a training tool, and we want this training tool to reach chronically unemployed individuals, because in the past we did not target them. So how can we be more inclusive of them? So already it's, like, a great brief, right? And so we created co-creation panels of both, like, people who are underemployed and chronically unemployed, but also community-based organizations to get their expert feedback on things. Because they are also the ones that know the community the best. And I think that's important to highlight. Like, sometimes our role as designers is to, like, get out of the way, yeah, and make sure the people talk to the right people. So we looped them in. And then as we started, like, discussing, ideating, we, like, more and more realized that this is a tool that is useful, but it's not necessarily appealing to chronically unemployed at the moment, because they have very urgent and other needs. But what it does serve actually is underemployed individuals who are, like, gig workers. They have multiple part-time jobs. So with that, I think co-creation is kind of also being a little bit outcome agnostic, like, because there's a lot of reframing that happens we see during the process as we start talking to the people, right? And exploring with them. So we went back and kind of, like, shared this roadmap and saying, like, okay, this is how your tool can be inclusive of underemployed if you need to launch this year, right? And this is how you can continue to work on this tool and with CBOs to to make sure it is becomes more inclusive of chronically unemployed individuals. So with that, they're launching the tool in January. We created them a playbook on how, like, the entire approach they can take, and also to onboard any new team member that comes to their team, because I think what we also see in corporations or like big institutions, there's a lot of turnover. So we do a project and the entire team leaves and you're like, is it continuing, right? So we wanted to make sure it was accessible and playful enough for anybody who was coming on board could like digest and really like continue on the work. So after like a year of them continuing without us, they're actually like ready to launch now and they're launching soon. And we just like had an update session with them recently. So that's like really good to see, especially on like more like government institution side, seeing that, well, if it's feasible there, we can really do it anywhere.
There was a term that you used, playbook, then, and that was an interesting term. I've not heard that phrase before used in that context. What do you mean by that? Because I think that's quite powerful as a term.
Yeah, because I feel like, you know, companies are like overwhelmed with guidelines, frameworks, tools, I don't know, like so many different, like, you know, 2030 goals, 2050 goals, a lot of just like things that like seem like rules and regulations, right? And goals, but like not really actionable. I think going back to our conversation on action and not very interactive, not very like accessible in language in some ways, like really just and being announced like federal laws and then suddenly expecting everyone to understand, relate and adopt tomorrow. It doesn't work that way. So playbook is much more playful, right? Like you read, but you also do an activity. You also reach out to another team member to like do an exercise. If you're going to go into a meeting, there's like tools and games or templates you can use in that meeting. So really making it more intuitive by offering different things and also repeating the message, like being redundant actually in the core message and the design principles and guidelines, to make sure it sinks, right? Because we like things really turn into habits when we get to practice them. And if it's not easy to practice them, we're not going to practice them. It's not going to turn into habits. So really making sure that they're practicing the same thing through different means, whether those are like activities or meeting setups or discussion guidelines or language to use, do's and don'ts, like so many things that they can just quickly look at. That is very visual, very interactive. I think that approach needs to be taken if we want these strategic roadmaps in a more fancier way to be adopted by a larger population from the companies.
That's great. And it's, yeah, because it's about, it's kind of onboarding through doing, but it's also gamifying an onboarding process, isn't it? And guiding people along in a playful way, which I love. I love that. That's great.
And just showing something fresh, you know, I think like I did a workshop recently. There's like 60 engineers in the room and they like it started with the corporate like presentation. And then I went in to like facilitate a session. And I think the biggest feedback I got was like, it was just nice to see something different. Like, you know, like not like I learned this or that. They were just like, those are just like nice to look at, you know? So they're so overwhelmed by like same like templates and same type of PowerPoints and unfriendly like tools. And I'm sure we all experience this in some capacity that it's not human, right? Like we like purposefully, for example, on the playbook, which I don't think Department of Labor has any, like ever seen anything like this. It was a lot of hand sketches because we wanted it to feel work in progress. We didn't want it to feel final polished book that comes from like, you know, big consulting companies that are very like fancy, like 1,000-page report. We wanted it to feel like, yeah. And you also start sketching on it or like writing on it too. So it was very, I think it's like we need to, as sometimes we need to take ourselves less seriously.
So earlier you talked about individual opportunities for change. How do you manage that against your work with corporations when, I mean, there's a big stat that gets thrown around at the moment, especially in the UK, where we've had this myth of individual change will change the world, and it's 70% of the emissions that cause the problems are caused by like five big companies or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do you, that dichotomy of the two things together of,
yeah.
Because if everybody really did make a change, it would make a difference. But how do you, I suppose my question is, how does that work? Do you go for the big corporate change, or do you go for the individual change, or do you try to do both at the same time?
Well, quick answer, both, because we really can't address anything without both like bottom up push and top down strategy and policy, right? So that private public collaboration, like institution individual collaboration, is key to reach any solution. That said, I think that to your point in like people being told what to do, and then like corporations being like responsible for the biggest part of emissions, like I do agree, like that's total BS, because like we're, you know, like I really find it frustrating when all the responsibility is left on people or like consumers, because like, hey, these are like mechanisms we maybe like created over time, maybe we were like part of it, but like we're all responsible. No one party is responsible in one thing. And also, even like with like our consumer goods, right? Like we've been brainwashed about the benefits and usage of like plastics, and now we're like shamed if we're using it, right? So it can't be just on the general public, the responsibility, but each and every one of us are responsible. And with that, I think how we position our process and work is that, especially when we're working on projects, asking questions like, how might we adopt sustainable practices? We make sure we not only like co-create and interview and discuss and ideate with end users, but also employees at the company. Because to really reach human centricity, we need to go out from the mindset of like consumer centric. Like, because I think even like why we see user centricity is adopted well in the tech world or beyond, it's like, okay, how can I create a more convenient experience, more smooth, more frictionless, like easy to use? But there is not much mention of, you know, the same approach is not used in other areas because it's not serving capitalism, to our point, right? Like, but we really, if we really want to address a change or start like internal change among all of us, then we really need to loop in both like company employees at different level and end users to co-create together. And we did this for a large international consumer goods company recently, where we had interviews from seven different regions with like consumers, but also with diverse functions within the company in exploring how might we adopt sustainable practices. Because consumers are restricted by the options they're given. Awareness and usage is one thing. But like, even though so many companies have 2030, 2050 goals, not many project teams adopt projects that kind of like resonate with that, right? Like they're going about their way, doing about their day-to-day operations. So how do we adopt on the both sides? How might consumers adopt what is the option that is more sustainable? And how do employees at companies really push for that change? I think we need to address it together. So going back to the essential need of collaboration, right? Like if we don't all work on this together, we're not going to solve anything.
I'm going down this thing in my mind about what we're talking about is cultural shift, but also behavioral change. And those two things are obviously very human things and aren't very systematic and are unpredictable. I suppose I'm kind of leaning on this thing of like, how do you do that in a way that isn't this institutionalized, hierarchical, do as you're told thing, you know? I don't know if you've got anything on that, but that's kind of where I'm.
I do. This is how I start my presentations. Oh, this is exciting. I love this question. So I like, exactly to your point, everything ends up like the knot is at the humans, right? Like if we were to look at, again, like what we were saying, the events, patterns, structures in the world, those are all fed by mental models and that's us, right? Or if we're like launching a new product, even if we feel like we're working on a more like still like complicated but controllable area where we know what we don't know and we analyze and then launch into the world, right? Like once we launch anything out into the world, humans again get involved and we make things complex. So we live in a complex world. This is like, and I think there's also like a specific term that we use for today's world. It's called VUCA. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. That's basically the world we live in today. So once we like acknowledge that any environment we're in is complex, is a complex system, if anything, just because humans are there, then we can like rely on science to like understand like in systems theory how we approach complex systems, right? So complex systems by definition is, you know, the world of unknowns. You don't even know what you don't know. So we can't go in and analyze and come up with like, oh, this is the best solution. That's a very engineering approach, which works well in, you know, complicated systems where there's like a finite number of unknowns and we analyze and we come up with the best, a good practice recommended by experts. But in complex systems, you don't know what you don't know, so you can't analyze. So the best way to approach the system is actually to probe, which calls for that experimentation prototyping we're talking about. And ideally, we set up safe to fail experimentations to test and iterate and test further. And after that probing, really seeing the outcome and then responding. So we come up with not like a good practice, but an emergent practice that emerges from that probing and that iterative experimentation. So that basically means innovation, like innovating, whether that is like a high-tech innovation, but or basically a process intervention, right? I'm talking about innovation in a much more flexible way. Innovation is a survival strategy in our day and age. Like there is no other way we can approach the world we live in today. So we just need to understand that we are ourselves a complex system, wherever we're in is a complex system and the world is a complex system. And therefore, we really need to adopt the behavior of like rapid prototyping, right? Even going back to our earlier conversation and being much more open to experimentation and change.
Great.
Hope that answered your question.
It did massively. Yeah. Yeah. And for that to be a, and for that idea of experimentation, the idea of safe to fail and the idea of trying stuff. But to have a culture of trying stuff where everyone is bought into the idea of, look, we're just trying it. It might not work. It might not happen. There's no trying way. There's no, you know, holy grail here, you know.
You know, exactly. If a company launched a product and communicated it that way, I feel like we would be less reactive to things anyway. Like now companies launch things as like the thing that solves all problems, right? And you're kind of like, you know, there's a lot of reaction through people and it's not like taken well, rightfully so. But if companies launch things like, hey, we're trying this in this field, we see this as first version prototype, we would love community feedback, like we would love all your feedback so that, you know, next time we do better. Like if companies adopted a much more open and transparent communication allowed by legal and PR, then we would actually be in a much better way of like feeling that there's co-creation, right? Like people would actually feel more part of the process. So we need to adopt, I mean, obviously for all of its like vices, social media brought in some of that like transparency, right? Like companies became more and more transparent. I think with like younger generations, we're seeing like more openness also in like communication and collaboration. So that shift is happening. But we really need to just change our mindsets about like we did it and it's the best, here you go. But really seeing this is like, this is what we tried. What do you think? Like seeing it as an ongoing communication with consumers and users. And really also acknowledging that our like preferences and perceptions change, right? Like even in like, if you think about language, some words we were probably using 10 years ago are maybe not proper language today, right? Like language evolves, what we like evolves, technology evolves, therefore our behaviors evolve. So we need to acknowledge that we're never gonna get it done. And just because something is not adopted like tomorrow doesn't mean it's not gonna be meaningful for the future. So we have to also, we need to adopt a safe to fail approach, but also we need to look at failure is not as failures, but really learning curve. Even though we say that, we don't necessarily always practice that.
So we need artists. We need creators. Yeah. We need dreamers. We need all those people. But
we need everybody.
Yeah, yeah. This is
I tell you should come and work in product, mate, because this is all product.
Yeah.
So this UX and design is all that sort of space where it is that it's creative, but it's collaborative.
Critical
thinking. It's about making those choices for the right thing with the right people at the right time and moving through. It's sort of the stuff that if you can get people around a table, it's about bringing everybody's opinion to it to understand the best approach. It's not about just that hierarchical thing.
Mm.
And you can sit in, I'm sure you do it with the design stuff that you're talking about, is we sit in products and we sit around and we go, right, well, we need to do this. How do we do that? Well, we grab an engineer, we grab a designer, we grab a user researcher, we grab someone who uses it at the end, and we all talk about it, and then we go, right, well, let's go and try that, and you fail, safe to fail, we call it fairly fast. So you try something, and if it fails, well, you're looking for your minimum viable product, essentially. What's the least I can do to give you as much as possible?
Mm.
And there's that great drawing of the bike, the wheels turning into a car.
Mm.
And you go from, it's a bit of a car.
Yeah.
Or you've got,
here's
a skateboard, here's a scooter, here's a bike, here's a car.
Yeah.
And it's changing that iteration. Well, you want to get somewhere, so let me give you some wheels and a board to roll on.
Yeah.
And you
make it better each time.
Wow. One of your What's Wrong With podcasts, I believe, it refers to the term circularity. And when we started playing with this project that we've called Circularity these number of years ago, that word wasn't really a normal word that people used. And it now over time, I mean, obviously, you know, the circular economy has a huge part to play with it. But this word circularity is suddenly becoming a thing that people are talking a lot about. And I just wanted to ask, how does that fit into your sphere, you know, this idea of circularity?
Yeah, so we often, and we did a talk on that like a few years ago also, like collaboration for circularity, right? And I think we need to recognize what kind of human collaboration is necessary to achieve each step, right? If we really want to, you know, complete a full circle, what do we need to realize along the way? And how do we also like design that process with human behavior in mind? I think that's something that we're like really in deep exploration in all projects, but also like ongoing. How do we design for human behavior so that the system we're creating or the process we're creating or the product we're creating becomes resilient, right? It's adaptive because it is informed by systems. Like so many systems we create today are either underperforming or failing because it wasn't like going back to complicated complex, right? Like we design it in a complicated world. We launch it as if it's going to like function as a complicated system, but no, it behaves in a different way because people get involved. So I think like really recognizing each step, like if it's about refusing consumption, right? Like, what does that call for? And how do we create products and environments that kind of help with that? If it's about reducing, how do we create products and environments or services that could help with that? If it's recycling, how do you, again, create all these systems that work for people? There are many like case examples that we come across in our research or projects where like there are good practices in place and great intentions, and they're not working because they're not designed with people or like didn't have a human-centered approach. One very particular example, we're talking about this, and exactly, Rob, to your point, I feel like these like design thinking approach, we see it most in maybe UX design, then a little bit like service design, product design, urban design is like try to grapple a little bit from it, but it's not there yet. And like architecture is like way behind, right? Like that's what we see right now. So we're talking to a property manager and he's talking about how like they were giving incentives for like proper recycling practices to like households, right? And then they tried so many different things and it was not working. And then eventually they decided to check the cameras of like the waste room sort of they had. And they realized a lot of households give their kids like the discarding as a chore, right? So the kids go into the room and they can't reach the chute that is like supposed to recycle. So the problem was not about like the incentives. It was a very basic like design problem that was in place because it wasn't created with the understanding of like the community, right? Like what are the community practices? And that's like one of the myths I also want to bust here. Like there's a perception around co-creation is like expensive, time consuming. Like, first of all, if you start working with the communities or people, like you're just like 50% ahead of the game. Like you're so much better informed to create like a right outcome. And also like coming up with design interventions or like quick design fixes after like this process is so much more cost effective and not always like expensive. I think I feel responsible as a design studio, like hiding behind the excuse of a budget. Like in regardless of budget, there's always some level of co-creation that can happen. And I think we need to, you know, move away from that. So to your point, I think like if we really want to achieve circularity, we need to have to understand in each step, like what are the community needs and whatever system we're talking about to make it like circular, who are the stakeholders? How do we create a process that are inclusive of the people that are going to be involved so it actually functions and it's actually working and we're not dealing with problems like, I don't know, like 80-something% of plastics are not recycled in US, even though like they are recycled, but they don't end up being recycled because it's not properly recycled. And this goes back to many different reasons. And this is only like one tiny case example.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. Where's next for Sour? Where you know what's kind of the next steps? Where do you want to go with it? What do you want to do with it?
That's such a tough question. We want to do everything. you know, that's like when you're a missionless studio, you're so spoiled because you could be working in anything as long as you're serving the mission, right? And then we get to meet so many cool people and like progress makers, boundary pushers. We're kind of like, oh, we want to collaborate with you. Oh, we want to work with you. Like, you're awesome. Can we do something together? So we really want to, I guess, like, well, we do like, obviously research is very much our characteristic. Co-design is like kind of what we practice. So storytelling is really how we feel connected to the world. And we feel like then we're actually creating a broader conversation and dialogue with everybody. So we would want to really just like reach more people to talk to more people and potentially ideate more people. So you could see in the future our storytelling mechanisms growing and evolving. That's one thing. And then it really, I think, so we recognize, and you know, there are some studios who are just like, you know, we will work on projects that serve the greater good. We have total respect for that, but we also do believe like there needs to be studios like us that kind of get into the uncomfortable to make like a nudge of a change to create some impact, right? And this calls for collaboration with larger institutions and corporations, because as difficult as that change is, the impact is huge. So we're just looking to work with like continue to work with many other large corporations to kind of like, can we move the needle, right? Like that's what we're like aiming for. So we'll continue to work on many projects, no matter in what type of packaging it comes, to continue to serve our mission.
That's inspiring. And I suppose one last question to finish with, if you don't mind, is what so far in your journey through Sour, and working, you know, as a studio, what are you most proud of? And I know that that's changeable. I know that that's not always the same thing, but just right now, you know, thinking now, what are you most proud of?
Such a good question. I'm proud of so many things. and it's never like, oh, this project or that award, right? I'm just like really proud of like our team's like collective stubbornness. Right? Because, like, it takes a certain level of, like, individual discomfort to go in the lane and say, like, oh, there's no paved way here. Why not we walk that way? Or or let's take on something that someone never has done before. So I think it takes a certain level of, like, mindset and willpower to do that. So I'm just, like, proud of the team to really just be on board of, like, whatever crazy brief we get, right? Like, and the craziness could also be like, it's a very cool project, but we need to do it in 3 months. Can we do it? Let's do it because it's important, right? Like, so really, like, almost like rooting for a soccer team. Like, that's how we kind of like, that's sometimes how we're on projects, and really also having fun doing it too. I think that's the important part of, like, making everything human as well. Like, you could see some of our, like, project reports to corporations who've never seen anything like that. Like, you could actually see some, you know, co-creation sessions being featured with quotes with some, like, mariachi band playing in the background. It's like, this is not unlike for Sour.
Yes!
So I think, like, I'm proud of us, like, not taking ourselves too seriously or, like, having fun with it, but at the same time, recognizing the weight and seriousness of the issues we're dealing with and approaching with that willpower and just stubbornness to, like, continue to work on them, no matter what people tell us. So that's what I'm most proud of.
Changing the world and having fun at the same time. That's what I'm
Yeah. With mariachi bands.